Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, milestones of faith, including a visit to the Schola Saxonum, once the hospice for the English in Rome. And defining the medieval pilgrimage, when sandals were with travel sore. Also, on a different note, the Roman emperor who lived at the time of Jesus. Well, thanks very much for joining me once again. In a few moments, I'll be taking you with me to a place I can just catch a glimpse of from my office window. It's a place of memory for the English in Rome, yet one largely unknown to the average English who come to Rome today. Eager as they are to reach St. Peter's Basilica, they leave it behind, ignoring. As I did myself, until historian Stella Fletcher made up for this failing. Join me as she takes me on a guided tour there.
Yes, it's linked to the English in two ways. First of all, back in the period that many people regard as the Dark Ages, but that those who know anything about it regard as the Light Ages, back in that period, this was the site of the so-called Schola Saxonum, the hospice of the Saxons, by which they meant the English. This is the time of Alfred the Great. There's already at that stage a great number of English pilgrims coming to Rome and they need somewhere to stay. So they stayed here until there was a fire. It was said by the Romans that the English caused the fire themselves and the whole thing burnt down. Then, in the high medieval period, Pope Innocent III built a hospital on this site. And indeed, we are standing in a hospital ward, believe it or not. Now, does it look much like a hospital ward to you?
It looks more like a church because of all the frescoes.
Yes, there are frescoes, and we've got a building here, a long, long building with two wards. This might have been the male or the female ward, I can't remember. But in the middle, there's an altar. The idea being that all the patients in their beds could see the altar from wherever they were. I mentioned that the hospital was originally founded by Innocent III in the high medieval period, but it was refounded in the 1470s by Pope Sixtus IV. Indeed, he provided lots of money for the hospital and initiated a book in which people signed to support the hospital and made donations to the hospital. Anyway, the other English connection comes in this time, the time of Sixtus IV. And indeed, all the paintings, the frescoes that we see up there between the windows are of Sixtus and his court, his family, his nipoti, his nephews. Now, where's the English connection in all that? It so happened that an Englishman called Robert Fleming, who was a great scholar, came to Rome in the mid-15th century as the king's ambassador, his proctor. In the 1470s, Robert Fleming returned. He was again in Rome between 1473 and 1477, exactly the time when Sixtus was having this hospital rebuilt. During Fleming's time in Rome, there was a plague. There always was plague in the summer months. And the whole of the papal court in 1473 went off into the hills. They went to Tivoli. And Fleming went with them. While up at Tivoli, Fleming wrote this long poem, Lucubrati Unculi Tributini, which told of the early life of Pope Sixtus. Much of it was already mythology, even in the Pope's lifetime. And it was that poem which provided a lot of the material for these frescoes.
Right up there.
Including the one that we've got just in front of us there, which shows Sixtus refounding the Vatican Library. He's there with his nephew, Giuliano della Rovere, who became Pope Julius II early in the next century. In fact, they're pretty poor frescoes in many ways. And in that one in particular, we can see that the figures have just been copied from a more famous fresco by Melozzo da Forlì, which is now in the Vatican Art Gallery.
It's not the grand library that we have today in the Vatican, is it?
Oh, no, no, indeed. Of course, that part of the Vatican wasn't built until the 16th century, and a purpose-built library was built at that stage so that the expanding collection could be housed. Yes, that new library, the library where I work most days here, is a late 16th century building. But originally, in the mid-15th century, Pope Nicholas V set aside two or three rooms in the old part of the palace, near the Torre Borgia. It's a sort of higgledy-piggledy area. And he was to house his library there. He was a genuine man of letters. One room was devoted to Greek books, one to Latin books. I'm not sure what was going to go in the other one. I doubt it was going to be the vernacular. Perhaps that was the room for the librarian. Anyway, Sixtus came along a few years later, decided that libraries were good things to be into, and it made you look good if you patronised a library, if you founded a library. So he refounded the Vatican Library. It had already been perfectly well founded by Nicholas V. And there's Sixtus with his librarian and his nephews. And we can probably just make out some desks with books on, because in the late medieval, early modern period, books tended to be kept chained to desks. Don't suppose, as far as I can see, I don't doubt they are chained. In fact, they probably weren't, because you could borrow books from the Vatican Library. And the librarian who is pictured up there, Bartolomeo Platina, did indeed start a book in which he recorded who had borrowed what, and indeed when they returned the books, if they ever returned them at all.
Well, I very much hope you enjoyed that tour of the Scuola Saxonum with historian Stella Fletcher. And now moving on in the broadcast, it's time to join Jill Bevilacqua as she presents a special feature focusing on pilgrimages.
Spring comes, and people wake out of their winter apathy and are stirred by a desire to go on pilgrimage.
When the sweet showers of April fall and shoot down through the drought of March to pierce the root, and the small fowl are making melody that sleep away the night with open eye, then people long to go on pilgrimages, and palmers long to seek the stranger strands of far-off saints, hallowed in sundry lands.
The opening lines of the prologue to Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. The pilgrims in the poem are travelling to the shrine of Thomas à Becket, martyred in Canterbury in 1170 and canonised a little over 2 years later. And as John Adair writes in The Pilgrim's Way,
"For more than 350 years, every English spring saw the roads of Canterbury thronged with pilgrims on foot or horseback, in litters or carriages."
The pilgrim of today doesn't have to wait for spring to make the journey, but can count on covered transport, whatever the season. In past centuries, pilgrimage was of necessity an open-air activity, dependent very much on good weather. If the outward manner or style of pilgrimage has changed, its essence has remained the same. It's still a journey to a holy place, undertaken, we may read, as an act of religious devotion, either simply in order to venerate it, or to ask the fulfilment of some need, or as an act of penance. Another motive quoted by some is in order to acquire spiritual merit. In an article on the pastoral importance of shrines, Marist brother John Samaha writes,
"A pilgrimage is a journey by the faithful to a shrine, a place made sacred. Shrines, Pope John Paul reminded us in 1987, are like milestones that guide the journey of the children of God on earth."
Paul VI described shrines as spiritual clinics, testimonies of miraculous deeds, luminous stars in the church's sky. Though there's a vast number of shrines to choose from, the supreme pilgrimage can only be that made to the Holy Land, where pilgrims were going as early as the 3rd century. Writes Brother Samaha,
"The spirit of the early and medieval church inspired pilgrimages to Jerusalem and Bethlehem, to the tombs of the apostles and martyrs in Rome, and to churches and shrines holding relics of saints. Internationally famous in the Middle Ages were Santiago de Compostela in northwestern Spain and Canterbury in England."
The pilgrims of the past, as we know, endured all kinds of hardship and were exposed to many dangers en route. But we are not expected to emulate them, as the Catholic Encyclopedic Dictionary assures us.
"Contrary to some common notions, a pilgrimage is not necessarily penitential. It need not be performed under conditions of physical discomfort, with great solemnity, nor are ordinary means of travel, for example, by train or motor car, essentially out of harmony with it."
Today's common-sense approach allows the pilgrim to travel in reasonable comfort, without tarnishing the spiritual aspect of his undertaking. If his destination is overseas, he may go by plane, which will give him more time at the shrine itself. And wherever he goes, he will almost certainly walk the last mile or two in order to enter into the spirit of the place. Our pilgrim may go with a parish group on a package deal, or privately with family or friends, or even alone. But in the last analysis, the value of a pilgrimage will not depend on how or with whom we travel, but on the spirit in which we make it. As the anonymous 9th century Irish author put it, with reference to a pilgrim coming to Rome,
"The king whom you seek here, unless you bring him with you, you will not find him."
But let's take a look at how it used to be, how people prepared themselves, and what were the symbols in that golden age of pilgrimage.
"Give me my scallop shell of quiet, my staff of faith to walk upon, my scrip of joy, immortal diet, my bottle of salvation, my gown of glory, hope's true gauge, and thus I'll take my pilgrimage."
These are the opening lines of a poem entitled The Passionate Man's Pilgrimage at the Point of Death. It was written by Sir Walter Raleigh in 1603, the night before he was due to be executed. After Henry VIII's break with Rome and his massive destruction of shrines in England, the pilgrimage tradition had suffered a decline. As for pilgrimages to the Holy Land, they were, as one writer puts it, as out of date as the Crusades. But the images of pilgrimage lingered on in the national memory, echoes of the great season of pilgrimage, the Middle Ages. The universal sign of the pilgrim was the scallop shell. Symbol of the shrine of St. James of Compostela in Spain, it was originally worn to show that the pilgrim had completed a journey to that shrine. But, as Sarah Hopper writes in To Be a Pilgrim,
"It came to be worn by any man or woman who had made pilgrimage to any venerated site in his native country or beyond. The scallop shell of St. James became such a well-recognised pilgrim token as to become the symbol of medieval pilgrimage as a whole."
Erasmus says that the scallop was adopted as the emblem of St. James of Compostela because the shore of that adjacent sea abounds in them. And Sarah Hopper writes,
"Scallops can be found from the southwest of England to the Iberian Peninsula, as well as on the Mediterranean and Atlantic coast of Morocco."
According to Brewer, the shrine of St. James was especially popular with English pilgrims. And in a note on the pilgrims' hats, sometimes referred to as cockle hats, he writes,
"Pilgrims used to wear cockle or scallop shells on their hats. The polished side of the shell was scratched with some crude drawings of the Virgin, the crucifixion, or some other object related to the pilgrimage. Being blessed by the priest, the shells were considered as amulets against spiritual foes and might be used as drinking vessels.
An essential item of the pilgrim's equipment was his staff, not only as a means of support, but also, if need be, of defence.
The staff often carried a single or double knob at the top, and most commonly a double-pronged iron spike at the bottom, probably to grip the ground when climbing. The pilgrim would also carry a scrip or leather satchel, usually suspended from a belt worn across the body. This would carry provisions and a water bottle, as well as the important pilgrim's letter of safe conduct signed by the church authorities.
Like the cockle shell, the scrip and staff became emblematic of pilgrimage. So significant were they for the individual pilgrim that not only were they fondly cherished as reminders of his great undertaking, but in many cases they were even buried with him. The German Dominican brother Felix Faber wrote that pilgrims bound for the Holy Land could be identified by four outward signs.
These were the red cross on a long grey gown, a black or grey hat with a red cross, a scrip and a long beard.
And women pilgrims? The traditional dress of the medieval pilgrim was very like what was worn generally in the England of the time, a long cloak over a tunic. But, as Sarah Hopper writes,
items that made this outfit unique to the pilgrim were a pair of sturdy boots for walking and a multifunctional broad-brimmed hat to protect against exposure to the sun, also useful for displaying souvenir badges. Important pilgrimage sites often sold souvenir badges that were mostly made of a tin-lead alloy or brass or clay. They were fitted with a pin or clasp so that the badge could be worn, and the surface was stamped with either a portrait of the saint, a scene from his life or death, or a symbol associated with him. Probably the most well-recognised and earliest pilgrim badge was the Palm of Jericho symbol, which pilgrims brought back from Jerusalem. It's from this symbol of the palm that the name Palmer for a professional pilgrim on perpetual pilgrimage came.
The dictionary defines palmer as an itinerant monk travelling from shrine to shrine under a vow of poverty. Originally, though, it referred to the ordinary pilgrim who brought back from the Holy Land the consecrated palm branch, which on his return he would lay on the altar of his parish church.
His sandals were with travel tore, staff, budget, bottle, scrip he wore. The faded palm branch in his hand showed pilgrim from the Holy Land.
Sir Walter Scott's Marmion. In 1808, when these lines were written, a budget was not what we mean by the word today, the Chancellor of the Exchequer's annual financial statement. It meant a little bag or pouch, usually of leather. Pilgrimage in the Middle Ages was no haphazard affair, to be undertaken at the drop of a hat. Before making the journey, certain important matters had to be attended to. Debts must be settled, and any outstanding disputes resolved. A will must be drawn up, naming eventual heirs and detailing the purpose of the pilgrimage, destination and intended length of time away. The pilgrim had to obtain permission from his overlord, bishop or abbot if he were a monk. If approved, he would be given a letter of commendation, which he must carry with him. This was important, as it showed he was not a vagrant. It made him eligible for the privileges of a pilgrim, such as alms and lodgings, and it was a definite status symbol. Finally, it was essential for the pilgrim to receive the church's blessing before he could go on his way rejoicing. Indeed, there was a specially written consecration ceremony followed by the ceremonial adornment of the subject in the recognised pilgrim's garb. Sarah Hopper recounts.
This religious ceremony, which commended the pilgrim to God and to service as a pilgrim, was called the Ordo ad Servitium Peregrinorum. The subject would be blessed along with each article of pilgrimage that would go with the pilgrim. The Sarum Missal, written between 1150 and 1319, included the Mass and blessing to be performed for this purpose. The Almighty and Everlasting God, who is the way, the truth, and the life, dispose your journey according to his good pleasure. Send his angel Raphael to keep you in this your pilgrimage, and both conduct you in peace on your way to the place where you would be, and bring you back again on your return to us in safety."
After making his confession, the pilgrim prostrated himself in front of the altar. With the congregation as witness, pilgrim status was then conferred on him through consecration of his scrip and staff, sprinkled with holy water, and placed correctly on his person. The cloak of the pilgrim to Jerusalem was adorned with a red cross at the shoulder. Often pilgrims were escorted to the city gates or just outside the town by members of the village, guild or brotherhood, who sometimes even made a small donation in the hope of sharing somewhat in the merit of the pilgrimage. And having seen him on his way, let us bid farewell to our medieval pilgrim, thankful perhaps that we are not so hemmed round with precepts and usages. But, as John Adair writes in conclusion,
"We should be wise to refrain from looking down upon the beliefs and practices of those pilgrims who travel to the saints' shrines. For we are spiritual wayfarers also, and we may well reflect upon the old English proverb, 'God knows well who are the best pilgrims.'"
Many thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett, whose voices you've just heard. And finally, to end this broadcast, a total change of pace and tone as we meet up once again with our resident Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Be sure to stay tuned. We're going to speak about Tiberius. I know that your students are studying Tiberius, aren't they?
Well, we always read about Tiberius.
What makes him so special?
Well, I mean, he's a gigantic figure in Roman history. 14 to 37, so 23 years.
23 years. But he was crazy, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't. No, Tiberius wasn't crazy.
Didn't he have a house in Capri?
Okay, at the end of his life, he kind of went off a little deeply.
How do you say it? How do you say that in
Latin? Aliquantulum delirabat, or insaniebat.
Insane.
He was acting a little strange. But this is way at the end. You know what I always tell the Catholics? When Jesus in the Gospel says, "Give to God the things that are God, to Caesar the things that are Caesar." No matter how we look at it, Jesus is talking about Tiberius, who is half out of his mind on the island of Capri. Now, when he said, "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's," in fact, there was only one Caesar in the world who happened to be Tiberius. The last 9 years of his life, he was kind of off his head, which would work into those last 9 years of Jesus' life. Which is kind of sobering, but a lot of people don't realize this. And so when he says, "Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's," Jesus is talking about this nutty emperor.
So can we talk about the better Tiberius?
No, the fact is, one of the greatest general that the Romans ever had, and he ran the empire. His problem was he was tough, a hard man.
A bloody tyrant.
No, he was not a bloody tyrant. He's a hard man.
So how do you say bloody tyrant?
Okay. Tyrannus cruentus. But the fact is, he was very just, but he was very, 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 very hard man.
He was like a dead-end emperor.
What do you mean dead-end? He wasn't a dead-end emperor. And the fact is, he did all kinds of things around the empire and that was another thing that a lot of people didn't like about him, is that he appointed a lot of his slaves as secretaries in the government. You'd say a secretary of defense or secretary of the treasury and so forth and so on. This is part of this organization that Tiberius brought in. And people never liked it. And he trusted these people and gave them...
Because slaves, you told me once, were sometimes very educated people who came from Greece,
absolutely,
for example.
And some of his people were first class.
So he realized this.
And so he called the administration or the structure of the Roman government was put in place by Tiberius. And as I say, people didn't like it because they wanted senator here and senator, you know, there, having these positions of responsibility. But Tiberius came along and put certain slaves in these positions of responsibility. They did a nice job.
So how did the senators react to this?
Complained all the time. What could they say?
Sour
Have
grapes.
Their heads cut off?
What?
Have their heads cut off?
He didn't do that.
Well, he
was a bloody tyrant then, I was right.
No, relax. At the end, he was a little kind of nasty. Mm. But it's interesting, for example, there isn't one building in all of Rome with his name on it. He refused to have his name put on the works that he was doing. So the fact is, he was a kind of a simple and austere man.
So the senators were moaning about Tiberius. It was a little bit like sour grapes. How do you say sour grapes in Latin?
Well, uva amara.
But it didn't mean anything to them.
No, but it meant something to Aesopus. I mean, in those famous stories about the animals there and the fox who's jumping up to get the sour grapes. The Romans knew about sour grapes. They did.
Aesop's tales.
Oh, yeah, we have Phaedrus. We have the same story in Latin. And so the wolf goes away and he says, bah, 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 they're just sour anyway.
So he was a...
He was a good man. He was an administrator and a general and everything else. And Claudius, he followed there and he confirmed this stuff about having the slaves, the administrators of the government. And so Claudius picked up on this thing. But I mean, Tiberius was not a bad man.
They say here, hard and secretive by nature.
Okay, hard is the word. Yeah, the fact is they said he had massive hands. And he'd just take someone's face and crush their heads.
Say that for me in Latin.
Manus sua illi debat nescio hominum capita. He used to crush the heads of people with his hands. He was so strong.
And there was no plastic surgery in those days.
No plastic surgery.
How do you say plastic
no,
surgery?
No, I haven't seen.
There's no plastic in those days.
Chirurgia plastica. Of course, plasticos is Greek. Goes back to 1000 BC, plasticos, which means formative.
So how would you say that in Latin?
You're going to say a chirurgia plastica. But the fact is, Tiberius is not a bad man. I don't care what Hollywood says.
How do you say, I don't care what Hollywood says?
Mea quid dicat Rusi Silva non interest.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover, his Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he spent most of his life as the Pope's very own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. If you did, please let me know. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Or if you wish to drop me a line, the address is The English Programme, Vatican Radio, Vatican City. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org/English. Bye for now, and don't forget that we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.